your basket, and you were welcome to help yourself as long as you took only one. I was in no particular rush, thinking William would be last off the plane, hampered by his painful, possibly life-threatening condition. I passed through the ticketing area and out the French doors into the small, grassy courtyard. I took my place near the chest-high stucco wall and watched through the length of window glass along the top as a uniformed gate agent pushed a wheelchair toward the prop jet. The engines shut down. Stairs were rolled into place. After a brief delay, the door was wrenched open and William appeared, his cane hooked over his arm. The natural eddies of air along the runway ruffled his white hair and tugged at his suit coat. A stewardess followed in his wake, supporting him gently by the elbow as he came down the stairs. He didn't actually smack her hand, but he was visibly offended by the gesture, and he jerked his arm free. He was properly attired for travel in the same dark three-piece suit he wore for funerals and visitations. He took his time descending the portable stairs like a toddler, first one foot down and joined by the other before he undertook the next. The remaining passengers crowded against the doorway, trying to determine what the traffic jam was about. William was not to be hurried. He was an elegant gentleman with the same lean frame Henry had been graced with. When he reached the tarmac, he turned and waited at the foot of the stairs, leaning on his cane while the other passengers pushed past him, giving him cross looks. The pilot appeared next, carrying a bulky red canvas duffel bag with a mesh panel on each end. Behind the pilot, the co-pilot, or possibly the flight engineer, stepped out of the plane toting William's black rolling suitcase. Somehow he'd not only claimed the right to deplane first, but he'd enlisted the assistance of the entire crew. They'd probably jumped at the chance to be shed of him. Whatever the motivation, William seemed to take the personal ministrations for granted. As far as I could tell, he was fine. Ambulatory, at any rate. He had the pilot place the canvas duffel in the wheelchair, which he manned himself, pushing it toward the terminal. When he caught sight of me, he winced and placed a hand at the small of his back as though stricken with sharp pain. The co-pilot flight engineer extended the handle on William's suitcase and tagged after him dutifully, pulling it along behind. As William and his merry band approached the terminal, I moved out to meet them and took over responsibility for the suitcase, murmuring my thanks to the crew. William paused and leaned his weight on the handles of the wheelchair. "Let me catch my breath," he said. "It's been a rough trip. Three stops and just as many changes of aircraft." I suspected he was hoping to generate a touch of sympathy, which I offered obligingly before he could up the ante. "You must be exhausted," I said.
"Not to worry. I just need a moment."
"Why don't you take advantage of the wheelchair and let me push you? It'll save you a few steps."
"No, no. I like to do for myself while I'm able," he added. "You might bring the car around. I doubt I can make it as far as the parking lot. I'll rest on one of the benches out front."
"What about checked bags?"
"This is it."
I decided I might as well take the duffel as long as I was heading for the car. I could put it in the trunk and then swing around and pick him up. I grabbed the satchel by the handle and lifted it from the seat of the wheelchair. It was heavier than I'd anticipated, and the contents shifted as though he'd packed a bowling ball without securing it properly. I said, "Whoa, what have you got in here?" I set it down and leaned over so I could peer through the mesh. A hissing white cat, topped with patches of caramel and black, put its ears back and spat. I jerked away, my heart hammering. This cat was the equivalent of the one in horror movies, jumping out when you're expecting the guy with the bloody butcher knife. "Where did that come from?" I asked, patting my chest.
"I brought the cat," he said complacently. "I couldn't bear to leave it behind. Lewis was going to take it to the pound."
"I'm not surprised. Talk about a cranky beast."
"Not as cranky as it would have been if I hadn't prevailed.
I wanted to have the cat with me in the cabin, but the ticket agent refused. I knew there'd be room under the seat in front of me, but she said it was the cargo hold or nothing. Her supervisor was just as argumentative until I mentioned my attorney. Why do you have a cat at all? This is the stray Charlie took in months ago. Lewis has been opposed all along, which just goes to show what a heartless fellow he is, I said. Ah, this is the cat Nell toppled over when she broke her hip. Well, yes, but it wasn't the cat's fault. Even Nell admitted she should have watched where she was stepping. William scratched affectionately on the top of the canvas duffel, which caused the cat to rocket around the interior and then ricochet from end to end. Very playful, he remarked. The cat began to claw at the side of the carrier so vigorously the zipper inched down a hair. I'd have tugged it back into place, but I didn't dare put my hand anywhere near the carrier. I didn't think the cat could reach me with its claws, but I wasn't sure the cat knew that. I returned the carrier to the wheelchair and pushed it as far as the entrance. In no way was I going to tote the cat through the parking lot to the car. I left William on a bench outside, the duffel at his feet, while I retrieved the Mustang, paid the parking fee, and brought it around to the front. William leaned over and said something to the cat, then jumped back as I had. He was apparently so caught up in the cat's playful antics that he'd forgotten about his infirmity. I put his rolling bag in the trunk and wedged the cat carrier into the space behind the driver's seat while William took his place in the front, wincing in pain. Are you all right? I'm fine. Don't mind me. I put the car in gear and eased away from the curb. I hadn't driven 10 feet before the cat let out a long, continuous howl, its tone moving up and down the scale as though yodeling. Does it always do that? Oh, no, just in the car on the way to the airport in all 3 flights. Airline passengers can be very unpleasant when things don't go their way. The woman in front of me had a horrid little girl who screamed and cried the whole time, but did anyone complain about that? No, sir. Is it male or female? I'm not sure. I think you're supposed to peek at something underneath, but the cat doesn't care for the idea. Charlie would know. He took it to the vet. Does it have a name? Joe? Sally? That might be a clue. We referred to the cat as the cat. I'm sure Nell or Charlie would have come up with a name, but Lewis kept threatening to toss it out, and neither of them wanted to get attached. If you think about it, I saved its life. A selfless act on my part. Good for you, I said. I must say I'm surprised Rosie agreed to go along with the plan. Where are you going to keep it? William and Rosie occupied a 2-bedroom apartment above the tavern. I'd never actually seen the place, but Henry assures me the rooms are small and dark and crowded with oversized furniture. William said, "Oh, it's not for me. I thought Henry would enjoy the companionship." Does Henry know about this?
Not yet.
Oh, boy. You think that's a problem? Far be it from me to say. We drove for a while in silence, except for the cat, which was now growling and making relentless work of canvas scratching in between thumps and flinging itself from side to side. I was trying to visualize Henry's reaction, which I knew would be genuine and heartfelt, and probably high-pitched. I've never lived with a cat myself, but I'd always assumed there was paraphernalia involved. I looked over at William, saying, "What about a litter box? Isn't that where cats do their business?" He blinked. "That's not necessary, do you think? Nell let it out in the backyard. But we live on a busy street. The cat will get hit by a car. Henry's going to have enough adjustments to make without the cat doing caca on his couch." "You may have a point. We better stop at the market. You can go in while I mind the cat." I think it was occurring to William that his plan was ill-advised, because his back problem seemed to take a sudden turn for the worse. He emitted a short yelp and sucked air through his teeth. "Are you sure you don't want me to drop you at the house and come back?" The minute I suggested it, I knew William would be too smart to introduce the cat without someone else close at hand. Henry would tone down his response if I was present. "The pain comes and goes. Sometimes it's no more than a mild tingling or dull ache, sometimes a burning sensation. The urgent care doctor said it could be due to a slipped disc or spinal stenosis. I'll have to have tests."
"You poor thing," I said.
To William, a test was the prelude to a terminal diagnosis. I left the 101 at Capillo and took surface streets in a zigzag detour to the nearest market. I left the howling cat in the car while William limped to and fro in the parking lot, flicking pitiful looks in my direction. I went into the store and wandered up and down the aisle devoted to pets, throwing items in my cart. The litter box was an easy choice, but there were 5 or 6 kinds of litter, and I had no idea what cats preferred in the way of toilet soil. I finally picked the one with 4 cute kittens on the package. I threw in a bag of dry food with only the briefest of debates about chicken versus tuna flavors. Then I bought 10 small cans of wet food, choosing items I thought I'd like if I were in the cat's place, only not as hostile. I nearly stopped at the payphone to call Henry, but he'd probably assume I was playing a practical joke. Thus it was that I searched out a parking space for the second time that afternoon, this one 3 doors down from my studio. I put myself in charge of William's rolling bag, and I even went so far as to remove the cat carrier from the back seat, lugging it in one hand as I maneuvered the rolling suitcase with the other. William held open the gate and then trailed along behind me, most reluctantly, I thought. I carried the duffel as far as Henry's back door and set it down.
"You can do the honors," I said.
When I looked back at William, he was bent double, staring at the walk as though searching for a lost dime.
"Oh, back's out," he said.
Henry opened the kitchen door.
"Good heavens," he said as he moved to William's side.
Between us, we helped him up the few shallow steps and into the kitchen. Moaning, William sank into Henry's rocking chair. I went back for the suitcase, and that's when I saw the cat's paw appear through a gap where it had worked the zipper down. I've never been present in a delivery room in the tender moment when a child is born, but I picture it much like this. The slit was no more than an inch long when the cat began to push through the opening. After the first paw, its head emerged, and shortly after that, one shoulder followed by a second white paw with a very long front leg attached. Cats are amazingly agile, as was plain to see. I watched, hypnotized, as though witnessing a miracle. "Hey, William," I said. But by then the cat had wiggled free and streaked off toward the shrubs. Henry snapped to attention.
"What the hell was that?"
Weakly, William said,
"Surprise."
Chapter 4 Tuesday morning I rolled out of bed at 6 o'clock, brushed my teeth, and pulled on my sweats and running shoes. A baseball cap eliminated the need to deal with my hair, which was flat on one side and standing straight out on the other. When I left the house, the only hint that the cat was still in the vicinity was a pair of mouse feet and a long gray tail on my welcome mat. I tied my key into the laces of one shoe and set out at a slow clip, hoping to warm up before I began to jog in earnest. Henry's dinner invitation from the night before had been superseded by our efforts to persuade the cat to come out of the bushes. Since William was incapacitated, it fell to Henry and me to crawl around on the newly aerated lawn, coaxing the cat with kitty treats and threats, all to no avail. Once it got dark, we'd been forced to abandon the attempt, and hoped that the cat would at least remain where it was until morning. The day promised to be warm. In typical California fashion, the damp and chill of the week before had been replaced by temperatures slated to reach the low 80s. A lingering marine layer hovered like thick white batting, but that would burn off by midday. As though in proof of this, a column of bright yellow sunshine illuminated the ocean just offshore, looking as though a monster hole had been punched in the clouds. I completed the 3-mile loop and slowed to a walk. I hadn't seen my homeless pals, and I wondered how many times the notion of their whereabouts would cross my mind. It was like having a tune lodged in my head, endless replays of a melody I couldn't seem to block. The week before, I'd known nothing of the dead man, and nothing of his friends. Now I was troubled by their absence. In deciding to dismiss the matter, I'd succeeded only in tempering its effect. Terence still hovered on the periphery, while I waited for someone to step forward with a few concrete facts. I suppose I'd assumed that once I knew what his story was, I could forget about him entirely and his cronies along with him. Home again, I showered, dressed, ate my cereal, and read the paper. When I left the studio, there was still no sign of Henry, William, or the cat. Either Henry had lured it inside, or it had remained stubbornly out of reach. I left the mouse parts where they were in case the cat was looking forward to a snack later in the day. I hadn't even known we had mice on the property. Now the population was down by one. Driving to the office, I spotted a pedestrian in a familiar herringbone sport coat poised across the street half a block ahead. He gave a quick look in each direction and then fixed his gaze on the sidewalk as he stepped up on the curb, heading in the same direction I was. I slowed and peered closely. Apparently, fate wasn't done with me, because, sure enough, it was Dandy, in baggy black trousers and a pair of bright white running shoes. I pulled over to the curb and rolled down the car window on the passenger side. "Dandy? It's Kinsey. You want a ride?" He smiled when he caught sight of me. "That'd be nice. I was on my way to your office. Hop in, and I'll deliver you to my door." I flipped the locks. Dandy opened the car door and slid into the passenger seat, bringing with him the cloudy smell of old cigarettes which seemed to cling to his clothes. His pale pink dress shirt was freshly ironed and had the stiffness and sheen of spray starch. I had to guess he'd spiffed himself up in anticipation of the visit. I could smell soap and shampoo, and the saturated scent of alcohol wafting through his skin. It was an odd combination, his efforts at personal hygiene undercut by his habitual intake of whiskey and nicotine. I experienced a piercing sense of protectiveness because he seemed so unaware of his effect. He held up my business card. "I never met a private eye, so I thought I better see for myself." "The office isn't much, but you can be the judge. I take it Pearl wasn't panting to see me again." "She doesn't like to walk. Me, I hoof it all over town. I apologize for her being rude the other day."
"Is she always that hostile?"
"I wouldn't fret if I were you. It's nothing personal. Terence was a good friend, and his death was a blow. She hasn't been handling it well."
"Why take it out on me? I didn't even know the man."
"She's disputatious, though she's not as tough as she'd have us believe. She may give you a hard time, but she's a pussycat at heart."
"Yeah, sure."
I took a right turn off Santa Teresa Street onto Caballero Lane, which was one block long. My office was the center one in the line of three small stucco cottages. In addition to the cheap rent, the location was close to the heart of downtown, in walking distance of the public library, the courthouse, and the police station. I pulled up in front. There were ample parking spots available, because the bungalows on either side of me were empty and had been since I moved in. Dandy got out and waited while I locked the car and joined him on the walk. He had a courtly air about him. Maybe it was the dress shirt, or the hint of humor in his eyes. I thought he seemed surprisingly intelligent, and then I had to stop and correct myself. Being homeless and being smart aren't mutually exclusive states. There might be any number of reasons he was on the street. I led the way up the front steps. I unlocked the door and opened it for him. "I'm putting on a pot of coffee if you're interested."
"I'd like that," he said as he followed me in.
"Make yourself at home. I'll be right back."
"Thank you."
I rinsed out the coffee pot and slotted it onto the machine, putting a fresh filter in the holder, which I popped into place. Over my shoulder, I could see Dandy in the outer office, where he browsed the various law books and texts in my collection. Everything from California criminal law to a 1980 edition of the Shooter's Bible. There were also the technical tomes about burglary and theft, Scott's fingerprint mechanics, arson investigation, the criminal mindset, and Adelson's pathology of homicide. When he drifted into the inner office, I left the coffee brewing in the kitchenette and joined him. It crossed my mind just briefly that he might try pilfering an item, but then I remembered I didn't have anything of value. No cash, no dope, no prescription medication, and no bottle of booze in my bottom drawer. If he wanted a ballpoint pen, I'd be happy to gift him with one. He'd taken a seat in one of the two guest chairs, clearly curious about my domain. I took my place on the other side of the desk and tried seeing the place through his eyes. As it happens, my office is devoid of personal touches. I have an artificial ficus tree that I think lends the room a hint of class, but the fake plant is about it. There are no family photographs, no travel posters, no bric-a-brac, and no paperweight advertising bail bonds, quick response. For the most part, my desktop was clear. All of the paperwork consigned to folders tucked away in the file cabinets lining one wall. He smiled.
"Cozy."
"That's one word for it," I said. "Can I ask a personal question?"
"As long as I'm not under oath."
"I was wondering, what brought you to Santa Teresa?"
"This is my hometown. I grew up 3 blocks from here. My father taught math at Santa Teresa High back in the 40s and 50s.
I made a face.
"Math's not my strong suit."
"Nor mine," he replied.
His smile activated dimples I hadn't noticed before. His teeth were charmingly buckled and flashed white against the dark of his complexion. "Did you go to Santa Teresa High by any chance?" I asked.
"Yes, ma'am. I graduated class of 1933, long before you were born. I attended City College for 2 years, but I couldn't see the point."
"Really? Same here. I went 2 semesters and then quit. Now I wish I'd stuck it out, but I sure don't want to go back."
"Better to get an education while you're young. My age, it's too late."
"Hey, mine too." "Did you like school?"
"I hated it. High school, at any rate. I was a low waller, smoking dope half the time."
Low wallers were the kids who loitered before and after classes on a low wall that ran along the backside of the school grounds.
"I was straight A's. Then life came along, and I guess while you went up in the world, I went down."
"I wouldn't call this up."
"Up from where I stand."
I didn't know if he viewed himself as a victim or a realist. I could hear the coffee machine gurgle to a halt, and I got to my feet. "What are you taking your coffee?"
"Milk and 2 sugars, please."
"Sugar, for sure. Milk could be a problem. Let me see what I can do." I left the office and went down the hall to the kitchenette, where I opened my pint-sized refrigerator and gave the milk carton a sniff. Slightly off, I thought, but I've heard that sometimes the residue of milk on the pour spout sours before the rest. I filled 2 mugs with coffee and added milk to mine, checking for the telltale curdling that suggests Boku bacteria at work. No evidence of spoilage. So I added a big dollop to his coffee and returned the carton to the fridge. I handed him his mug and 2 paper packets of sugar and resettled myself in my swivel chair. I held up a finger. Before I forget, I leaned down and extracted the 3 packs of cigarettes from the shoulder bag at my feet and pushed them across the desk. Consider this a bribe.
Much appreciated. I'll pass along a pack each to Felix and Pearl.
Pearl, in particular, I was hoping to elevate myself in her opinion. There was a dip in the conversation. My usual practice is to let the silence lengthen until the other fellow gets squirmy enough to speak his mind. This time, I took the lead. I'm assuming you didn't walk all this way to pay a social call.
Not entirely. Don't take this wrong, but your asking about Terence really set Pearl off,
as I'm keenly aware. What's the big deal?
She says you smell like a cop.
That's because I was a cop once upon a time. I was with the STPD 2 years, and then I got out. I like playing by the rules when it suits, but I don't like answering to anyone.
Understandable, he said. Then again, Terence hadn't been dead a full day when you came sniffing around. Her words, not mine.
Sniffing seems an odd choice. I told you I was hoping to locate his family, which is not a federal offense. Right now, he's a John Doe. His name might be Terence, but that's the extent of what we have. The coroner's office is swamped this week, so I said I'd see what I could find out. What'd she think I'm up to?
She's suspicious by nature, while I'm the opposite. I believe most folks are honest until proven otherwise.
My policy as well, I said. What else is bugging her? We might as well put all our cards on the table as long as you're here.
She thinks you're not being honest about who you're working for.
What, like I'm an undercover agent? I'm self-employed. None of my work has anything to do with Terence, dead or alive. You don't believe me, you can search my files.
You don't work for St. Terry's?
Nope.
You're not associated with the hospital or the university in any capacity at all?
No way. I'm freelance. I'll swear to it, I said. I don't have clients in the medical profession or any related field. And that includes dentists and podiatrists. I don't know how else to assure you of my sincerity.
I'll pass that on to her.
Are we square?
As far as I'm concerned.
Good. Then it's my turn. Why did Terence need the services of a PI? I asked before and I didn't get an answer.
He didn't spell out the particulars, but I know what was on his mind. He believed he had kin in the area. Growing up, he had an uncle he very much admired. The two were close when he was a kid, but he hadn't seen the man for years. Said he came to visit his uncle here shortly after the man moved to Santa Teresa. Later, he heard the fella died. He hoped to connect with family members, assuming there were any left.
He never mentioned his uncle's name?
No. I happened to overhear him talking about it to someone else.
Why pick me when there are 6 private eyes in town?
You know a fellow named Pinky Ford?
Of course. How do you know him?
He's a man about town, in some sense of the word. I haven't seen him in weeks, but he lives in a big yellow Cadillac he parks here and there. Terence was asking around, and Pinky told him you were a decent sort.
I'd like to think so.
Dandy cocked his head. How do you know Pinky? He doesn't seem like your type.
Long story, I'll save for another time.
I may take you up on it, he said. Meantime, what else can I tell you about Terence?
Do you know where he was from?
Bakersfield. I don't know if he was born there, but the way he told it, that's where he lived most of his life.
You met him at Harbor House?
That's right. He arrived here in January on a Greyhound bus. He'd been in prison up at Soledad. He said it was a life sentence, but that's all I know. He didn't like to talk about it. He slept a couple of nights under a freeway overpass and figured out it was a bad idea. The panhandlers with cardboard signs aren't as nice as the rest of us. You stand by the road begging, that's a different work ethic. Terrence tried the rescue mission, but they wouldn't take him unless he swore off alcohol, which he wasn't about to do. He heard about the shelter, and when he showed up, the first person he met was Pearl. She introduced him to Felix and me. Harbor House, you don't have to be sober, but you'd better not be obstreperous. Make trouble, and you're out.
It seems like a cool place, I said. I stopped by the day before yesterday looking for you.
Sunday, we throw darts. Sports bar down the block has a weekly tournament.
Are you any good?
Depends on what day it is and how much I've had to drink.
I noticed the woman in line ahead of me had a shelter ID card. At least, I think that's what it was. I wondered if Terrence had one. I asked because he didn't have any identification on him when the coroner brought him in.
Oh, he had a card. I'm sure of it. Harbor House issued one so he could take his meals with us. Someone walked off with all his stuff, so maybe it was in his cart.
He wasn't a Harbor House resident?
Not him. He didn't want a bed. Nights, he didn't like to be around other folks. He spent most of his time drunk, and he hung out with another fellow in the same sorry shape. Now and then he tried cleaning up his act without much success.
So he was in Santa Teresa, what, 8 or 9 months?
Sounds about right. He loved it here. He said he was never going anyplace else. March, the other fellow died, and Terrence went on a bender that landed him in jail. After that, he sobered up for a couple of weeks. Then he started in again and one day collapsed in the street. He was lucky he didn't die that round. Pain meds and alcohol are a bad mix.
No fooling, pain pills? What was that about?
Up at Soledad, some fellows went after him with lead pipes. Busted up his leg bad, leaving him with a limp and a load of agony. He didn't sleep well because of it. He had to get up now and then and walk around so it wouldn't seize up. That was another reason he preferred to be outdoors so he wouldn't bother any of the rest of us.
I saw the damage to his leg when I was at the morgue. What triggered the attack?
He wouldn't say. Some things you'd ask, and all he'd do is shake his head. When he spiraled down the second time, he ended up in St. Terry's. They put him through detox and then into rehab. Next thing I heard, he was on the street again. I didn't think he'd last a week. I figured it was just a matter of time before his demons got a hold of him and took him down.
Is that what happened?
No, he got into a program that put him back on his feet.
Apparently not for good. Dandy smiled.
There's no such thing as for good when you're one of us. It's for good until the first drink or you're back to chipping heroin. Meth, if you're really on a downward slide. Terrence went back to his old ways, and that was the end of him. Pearl didn't want to believe he'd started drinking again. Broke her heart, if you want to know the truth. He finally got clean, and then he couldn't maintain. Might sound odd coming from me. Nobody knows better than another drunk how hard it is to quit. Pearl believed he'd cleaned up his act. He gave her his word, and she took it seriously.
Do you know when he was last seen by a doctor? It would help if the coroner's office found a physician who'd sign off on the death certificate.
There was a doctor headed up the program. He's the one terminated Terrence for disobeying the rules. I know he wasn't feeling well the last couple of weeks. Much as he drank, it wasn't any big surprise. He was a wreck of a human being. And then he died. And that's the end of it.
What about his family? Any kids?
He burned that bridge a year ago. He was on the outs with his ex-wife and estranged from his kids. I don't know the whole of it, but I gather his kids as good as slammed the door in his face. He claimed he did everything in his power to make things right, but they weren't buying it.
What was the issue?
Dandy's smile was benign. Being drunk's the issue. What else you got? He gave up on his kids because they gave up on him. That's the kind of pain for which there's no relief.
It must have been hard on him.
He learned his lesson that round. He wanted to be clean and sober before he contacted his kinfolk, which is why he carried your name in his pocket for months. He needed a go-between, someone to smooth the way for him. After what happened with his kids, he was through with surprises, I can tell you that.
Meaning what?
The way he told it, his kids had no clue he'd come knocking at the door. He'd called and told them he wanted to make amends. But I guess they never thought they'd actually see him again, and good riddance from their perspective. I believe he'd had a fair amount to drink by the time he got there. I fussed at him good when he told me how he'd gone about it. Said, bro, it's not cool. It's not cool at all. When there's bad blood, you don't do that. Show up drunk and think your kids are going to welcome you with open arms. Doesn't work that way. Family's tough. It's like walking through a minefield hoping you won't get blown to bits, I said. I wonder what he was in prison for. He never said. Something bad must have gone down. I'm sorry he didn't call me.
He might have been too sick. With him back on the booze, he was probably ashamed of himself. He disappeared for a month last summer, and then he came back.
Disappeared to where?
Los Angeles, but I don't know what he did there. Give a fella his space is my attitude.
I tilted back in my swivel chair and propped my foot on the edge of the desk. Depressing, isn't it?
Not every life turns out.
Which I should know by now, I said. The coroner's investigator says all Terence had on him were the clothes on his back and the sleeping bag he died in. Didn't he own anything else?
Course he did. Had a shopping cart where he kept his cook stove, his books, and a custom-made tent. All gone by the time we got to the beach on the morning he died. He also had a fancy backpack with an aluminum frame. Somebody walked off with everything.
That's too bad. What kind of books?
These were textbooks, mostly. He loved anything to do with plants. Trees, shrubs, container gardening, propagation. He knew everything there was to know about California oaks. Drop of a hat, he'd talk your ear off. It was hard to shut him up once he got started.
Was he a teacher?
No, but he sure knew a lot. He said before he went to prison, he'd been working on a landscaping degree. He was a tree trimmer by trade, which was how he supported his family, but he wanted to be a landscape architect. Nights and weekends, he took classes.
Must have been a bright guy.
Very.
He was a sweet man, too. Dandy shifted in his chair.
Something else. Pearl didn't want me to tell you this, but I don't see why not. She thinks he had money. Lots of it.
Really? Do you agree?
Yes, ma'am. I'm not sure where it came from, but he didn't live check to check like the rest of us. He kept a roll of bills in his pocket this big around.
He made a sizable circle with his thumb and index finger. But that makes no sense. If he had money, why was he living on the streets? Why not rent a room?
He didn't care to spend his money that way. You might feel safe sleeping in your own bed, but to him it was a nightmare. Furnished room was just like a cell to him. Too hot, too small, too noisy. Camping out feels like freedom. Even I know that, and I've never been in jail. Except a time or two, he added, just to keep the record straight. Point is, what he could afford wasn't relevant.
So, where do you think the money came from?
Beats me. He might have gone to prison for embezzlement. He might have robbed a bank. He didn't seem like the sort who'd do either one, but What do I know? Any rate, he knew what he wanted done with it when he passed.
Such as what?
All I know is he went to that office supply place up on State. He bought him a kit full of legal forms so he could draw up his last will and testament.
That was enterprising.
Yes, it was. He filled it out and had us sign as witnesses, Felix, Pearl, and me.
I could feel my head tilt, like a dog picking up a high-pitched whine inaudible to us humans. How long ago was this?
July. I believe it was the 8th.
So, on the 8th of July, you witnessed his signature?
So did Felix and Pearl. We all did.
Then you must know his full name.
Dandy's change of expression was nearly comical. I'd nailed him, and he knew it. He'd been neatly sidestepping the matter of Terence's identity, but he'd forgotten to censor the secondary references. Once I had called him on it, he wasn't quick enough to fabricate a cover story. He looked at me as though I were blessed with psychic powers. I'm right about that, aren't I?
I never lied. I wouldn't do that.
But why didn't you speak up? We've been talking all around the subject, and you knew his name the whole time.
You didn't ask.
I asked the first time we met. That was the whole point. I came down to the beach to find out who he was, and I asked you straight out. The three of you were sitting right there.
Pearl said not to tell.
Are we still in grade school? Who made her the boss? I'm trying to do something nice for the man. Doesn't that mean anything to you? Whether he was on good terms with his kids or not, they have a right to know he's gone.
I noticed he'd stopped making eye contact, and he was busy picking at a snag on the knee of his trousers.
I said, "So, what was his name?"
I didn't think he'd answer. I watched him shift in his chair, wrestling with his conscience. On one hand, there was Pearl, the holy terror. If she found out he'd leaked the information, she'd break both of his clavicles, put him on the rack, and stretch him until she'd torn off his arms. On the other hand, there was me. All around good person, generous with my coffee, and only occasionally guilty of sticking my nose into other people's business.
Dandy?
R. T. Dace. He went by his middle name, Terence. But you never heard it from me.
I turned an imaginary key in my lips, locking them shut before I tossed away the key. Chapter 5. 15 minutes later, I dropped Dandy at the harbor house. He hadn't asked for a ride. I'd offered. Nay, I'd insisted. I wanted to get rid of him so I'd have a chance to think about what he'd said. Having chided him for withholding information, I'd been less than forthcoming myself. I'd actually heard the name R.T. Dace before. Twice, as a matter of fact. I couldn't remember the dates, but I knew of two distinct occasions in which people called to ask for him. What the heck was that about?
I left the shelter trying to recall the circumstances in which the phone calls had come in. It was distracting, trying to pin down the reference in a moving vehicle while hoping to obey traffic laws and avoid running over pedestrians. I turned into one of the public parking lots that looked over the beach to the ocean beyond. I pulled into a slot and killed the engine. I laid my head back and closed my eyes, slowing my breath, working to silence the chatter in my head. The inquiries had come months before, probably midsummer. I'd taken the first call at the office. I remembered that much. I tried to picture the cases I was working at the time, but my mental screen was blank. I set the point aside and focused on the fragment of conversation that had stuck in my mind. I was eating lunch at my desk when the phone rang. I put a quick hand against my mouth, chewing and swallowing in haste before I picked up.
Melhone Investigations. May I speak to Mr. Milhone?
The caller was male, on the young side, and his voice, while deep, suggested an underlying anxiety. I was already thinking it was a sales call, some boiler room trainee learning the ropes. I'd pushed the caution button in my head while I tried to guess the nature of the upcoming pitch. Telemarketers inevitably say, "How are you today?" in a tone that's patently insincere, using the question as a means of engaging you in conversation. I said, "There isn't a Mr. Milhone." The fellow cut in, but instead of the expected spiel, he said, "This is Dr. I blanked on the name instantly because I had zeroed in on the voice, thinking it might be one I recognized. "What can I do for you?"
"I'm trying to reach Mr. Dace."
"Who?"
"Artie Dace. I understand he doesn't have a phone, but I hoped you'd put me in touch with him. Is he there by any chance?"
"You have the wrong number. There's no Mr. Dace here."
"Do you know how I can reach him? I tried the shelter, but they won't confirm the name."
"Same here. I never heard of him." There was a brief silence.
"Sorry,"
he said, and the line went dead. I remembered dismissing the call the moment I hung up, though I half expected the phone to ring again. Wrong numbers seemed to come in clusters, often because the calling party tries the same number a second time, thinking the error is connected to the dialing process. I stared at the handset, and when the phone didn't ring, I shrugged and went about my business. The second call came within a matter of days. I know this because the name Dace had been planted recently enough that I hadn't yet deleted it from memory. I'd closed the office early, and I was having my calls forwarded. Henry and I were sitting in the backyard when the phone in my studio began to ring. I had left my door open for just this reason, in case a client tried to reach me. When the phone rang a second time, I leaped to my feet and trotted into the apartment, where I caught the phone on the third ring. "Milhone Investigations."
"May I speak to Mr. Milhone?"
This time the caller was a woman, and I could hear noise in the background that suggested a public setting. "This is Kinsey Milhone. What can I do for you?" The woman said,
"This is the cardiac care unit at Santa Teresa Hospital. We've admitted Mr. Artie Dace, and we're hoping you can give us information about what medications he's on. He's in and out of consciousness and unable to respond to questions."
I squinted at the handset.
"Who's this?"
"My name is Eloise Cantrell. I'm the charge nurse in the CCU. The patient's name is Artie Dace."
This time I'd picked up a pen and pulled over a scratch pad, making a note of the nurse's name. I added CCU. "I don't know anyone named Artie."
"The last name is Dace, initials R.T.
"I still can't help you."
"But you do know the gentleman, is that correct?"
"No, and I don't understand why you're calling me. How did you get my name and number?"
"The patient was brought in through the emergency room, and one of the nurse's aides recognized him from a prior hospitalization. Medical records located his chart, and the doctor asked me to get in touch."
"Look, I wish I could help, but I don't know anyone by that name. Honest." There was a stretch of silence.
"This isn't in regard to his hospital bill. He's covered by Medicaid," she said, as though that might soften my stance.
"Doesn't matter. I don't know anyone named Dace, and I certainly don't know what medications he's on." Her tone turned cool.
"Well, I appreciate your time, and I'm sorry to have troubled you."
"No problem."
And that was the extent of it. I opened my eyes and looked out at the ocean. Maybe Dace had tried to reach me, but he'd been ill at the time. The doctor whose name I'd missed and the charge nurse, Eloise Cantrell, had probably discovered my name and number in his trouser pocket the same way the coroner's office had. His handwritten note had said Milhone Investigations, along with my office number. Both callers had erroneously assumed that Milhone was a man. Dandy had just told me Dace carried the information with him for months. hoping to sober up before he asked for help. Though there were still gaps in the story, I was feeling better about the string of events. There's something inherent in human nature that has us constructing narratives to explain a world that is otherwise chaotic and opaque. Life is little more than a series of overlapping stories about who we are, where we came from, and how we struggle to survive. What we call news isn't new at all. Wars, murders, famines, plagues, death in all its forms. It's folly to assign meaning to every chance event. Yet we do it all the time. In this case, it seemed curious that Pinky Ford, whose life had touched mine 6 months before, had made another appearance, this time connecting me to the man in the morgue. It did help me to understand how some of the lines connected. Dace's choosing me wasn't random. He was acting on the recommendation of a mutual acquaintance. The referral hadn't netted me a job, but there was always the chance that a casual mention would result in future employment. In the meantime, the two phone calls regarding him and my name and number on that paper in his pocket were no longer mysterious in the overall scheme of things. I paused to correct myself. There had actually been three calls, the last one being from the coroner's office. Now that I thought about it, I'd had a number of hang-ups on my office answering machine. There must have been six in all. Someone calling while I was out and electing not to leave a message. There was no reason to assume that the caller was the same in every instance, and no reason to imagine it was R.T. Dace on the other end. But it was possible. Nothing to be done about it at this point, and I felt a momentary, formless regret. As long as I was only three blocks from home, I decided to stop off and see what kind of luck Henry was having with the cat. I'd left that morning long before William's appointment with the neurologist, and I was interested in an update on his condition as well. I found a parking spot across the street from Rosie's place and noticed that the tenting was down. I could see a workman closing the downstairs windows, and I assumed that both the restaurant and the apartment upstairs had undergone a thorough airing out. I locked my car, walked the half block, and made my way into the backyard. There was no sign of Henry, no sign of the cat, and no sign of William. Henry's kitchen door was open, and when I tapped on the frame, there was a lengthy delay. And then William hobbled into view from the direction of the living room. He held the door for me, and I stepped into the kitchen. "Henry is not here, but he's due back momentarily. Have a seat, and don't mind me if I stand. Hurts too much to get up and down. I'm better off on my feet." "I see the termite tenting's down. Will you be staying here or going home?"
"I'll go home if I can manage it. I'm sure Henry will be glad to see the last of me."
"What about all the kitchen equipment and supplies? Won't they have to be moved back in?"
"I suppose I can wait until Rosie gets home."
"I'll be happy to help. If you'll direct our efforts, Henry and I can do the work." I pulled out a kitchen chair and settled my shoulder bag on the floor nearby. William leaned against the counter with his cane to provide balance. I could see past him into the backyard, so I knew I'd spot Henry as soon as he appeared. "How'd your doctor's appointment go?" I asked.
"Dr. Metzger did a thorough examination and didn't seem to think an MRI would be necessary for now. He made a point of saying, 'for now.' 'Always have ammunition in reserve,' was the way he put it. He prescribed an anti-inflammatory, pain medication, and a muscle relaxant. I'm also to do physical therapy 3 times a week. I have a heating pad that I'm to use before therapy and an ice pack for after."
I sensed William's discomfiture that his medical prognosis had been downgraded from near death, past acute, down to the mundane level of pills, ice packs, and PT. Added to that shame was his miscalculation with regard to the cat. I said, "Well, thank heaven you came home when you did. If you'd stayed in Flint 4 more days, no telling how bad your sciatica would have been. At least you're under the care of a specialist." The doctor said so as well, that I'd done exactly what he would have done in my shoes.
Absolutely. Good for you, I said. When do your physical therapy sessions start?
Tomorrow afternoon. I believe the facility is not far from here. Of course, I don't want to be a burden, so I might take a cab. I hate to put Henry out.
Where'd you sleep last night? I thought both his guest rooms were stacked with items from the restaurant.
He offered me the couch, but I thought it best that I sleep on the floor. Once I managed to get down, which was no easy task, I kept my knees elevated so my back remained flat and properly supported. I slept as well as I could under the circumstances.
What's the situation with the cat?
Henry caught the cat, and he's taken it to a veterinarian who has an office not too far from here. He tried everything to persuade the cat to come out of the bushes, but I'm afraid he didn't have much success. He finally looked up the vet in the Yellow Pages. He was hoping she had a have-a-heart trap he could borrow, but hers was on loan to a group that rescues feral cats. She recommended a bit of cooked chicken, and it worked like a charm. The cat even allowed itself to be tucked into the carrier for transport. I don't know if I mentioned it, but the poor cat has no tail, just a stump covered with a tuft of hair. I have no idea what happened to him. Henry says the cat's pathetic, ugly, bad-tempered, and uncooperative.
Not too uncooperative, or Henry couldn't have gotten him in the carrier.
You're right. I hadn't thought of that, he said. I don't mind Henry being mad at me, but I don't want him to take it out on the cat.
Henry wouldn't do that, do you think?
He has no use for it, and he made that plain, but I don't know what he meant. He's hardly speaking to me, so I didn't have a chance to press him on the point. He wants to be rid of the poor thing, for sure.
You don't think he'd have the cat put down, do you?
The mood he's in, he's capable of anything. He refuses to have it here, especially after all the pain and suffering Nell's been through.
Couldn't the vet find a home for it?
That remains to be seen. Henry has no patience. He called Lewis, and Lewis said the same thing he's been saying all along. Take the cat to the pound and put an end to it. Henry says whatever happens, it's my fault for not asking in advance. He knew a fellow bitten by a stray who was stricken with cat scratch fever. His arms swelled up to 3 times its normal size. He was in the hospital for a week. Henry says, why take the risk? Fleas and God knows what diseases. He says the cat's fate is on my head.
Henry said that?
Words to that effect. I thought I was doing a good deed, but there's no predicting Henry. He can be hard-nosed.
I caught movement and looked up in time to see Henry's station wagon ease along the drive. He paused while the automatic door went up and then pulled into the garage. I heard the car door slam, and he appeared a moment later, hauling the carrier, which was clearly lighter and most decidedly empty. Stony-faced, he came into the kitchen and set the carrier to one side.
"That takes care of that," he said, and then looked over at me, his tone shifting from cranky to something more pleasant. "You're home early."
I murmured a response, realizing that I was sorely disappointed with the man. He was in no way obliged to keep the cat simply because William had taken it upon himself to transport it across the country. Henry had never expressed any interest in animals, and I'd never known him to mention a pet. Still, I counted on him to do the right thing, even if he wanted to be a grouch about it. He turned to William.
"You owe me $50.
William wasn't going to argue. He was already chastened by Henry's anger and repentant at having caused such an uproar. He had to feel worse about the cat than I did. He took out his wallet and counted off the bills, which he handed to Henry.
"May I ask what this is for?"
Henry said,
"The vet has to put the cat to sleep, and that's what it costs."
Both William and I said, "Oh," in tones of regret and bewilderment.
"What's the matter with you?"
he asked, looking from my face to William's. I said, "If I'd known you were going to have it put down, I'd have taken it myself."
What are you talking about? She's not killing the cat. She's cleaning his teeth, and he has to be sedated. I'm to pick him up at 5.
I said,
really? Well, that's great.
He seemed to be feeling self-conscious as he went on.
The vet says he's a Japanese bobtail, which is a rare breed. As a matter of fact, this is the first one she's seen in her entire career. Bobtails are active and very intelligent, easily trained to a leash, and talkative, she said, which I'd noticed myself. 2 people in the waiting room spotted him and volunteered to take him off my hands that very minute, but I didn't like their looks. One had a yappy dog the cat took an instant dislike to, and the other was a young woman who looked irresponsible to me. She had pierced ears and peroxided hair that stood up in spikes all over her head. I told the vet I wouldn't dream of putting the cat in the care of someone like that.
Well, that's wonderful, I said, patting myself on the chest with relief.
So, he's a male?
He was male.
Apparently he was neutered some time ago. The vet says neutering tempers aggression and will keep him from spraying and getting into fights with other cats. She also pointed out he has what they call heterochromia, meaning his eyes are different colors. One is blue and the other is a golden green. Odd-eyed kittens are more expensive than the ordinary ones.
William stirred, wanting to ask a question without generating any more ire on Henry's part.
Have you thought about a name?
Of course. The cat's name is Ed.
William blinked and said, good choice.
I said,
excellent.
Chapter 6. Pete Walensky, May 1988, 5 months earlier. Pete ignored the phone when it rang, letting his answering machine pick up while he sorted through the mail that had piled up over the past week. Idly, he tuned into his outgoing message, thinking as he always did that his recorded voice sounded manly, mature, and trustworthy.
Abel and Walensky, we're currently out of the office, but if you'll leave your name and number, we'll get back to you as soon as we return. We value your business and look forward to serving you with efficiency and discretion.
There was actually no Abel. Pete had adopted a mythical partner, so his agency name would appear first in the listings for private investigators. The caller didn't need to identify himself since he rang up 6 to 8 times a day.
Listen, you son of a bitch. I know you're there, so let's cut the bullshit and get straight to the point. If you don't pay what you owe, I'll come over there with a meat cleaver and chop off your shriveled dick.
Pete listened with amusement. Synchronicity being what it was Barnaby on the line again, calling on behalf of Ajax Financial Recovery Associates, whose officious written demands were spelled out in the letter he held in his hand, while the goober from the selfsame company spewed venom. In truth, the dunning notices were almost as bad as the daily calls, and both were getting on his nerves. Abusive tirades generated by clowns who weren't qualified for real jobs. What kind of fool spent his days in a cubicle badgering gainfully employed citizens about debts that might or might not be owed? Most debt collectors were rude, obnoxious, devious, and unprincipled. He filtered their calls, deleting a message the minute the caller announced his purpose. If he was careless and picked up the line, allowing one of his creditors to get through, he'd blast him with a handheld siren that would render a fellow deaf for the better part of an hour. He made an exception for Barnaby, whose threats were more vicious and imaginative than most. As soon as he'd recorded another week's worth of diatribes, he'd file a complaint with the FTC. He tossed the Ajax letter into the trash, along with the other overdue notices, a summons, 2 default judgments, and the threat of a lawsuit. The only envelope left contained a pre-approved credit card offer, which made him laugh aloud. Those assholes never gave up. He adjusted his glasses, leaning close to the application as he took a few minutes to fill in the particulars. He used his own name with an X as his middle initial. The rest of the personal information, employment, bank accounts, he invented on the spot.
wondering if the company would actually be foolish enough to issue him a card. It didn't bother him so much that he was broke. It was the unpleasantness he objected to, having to suffer the screaming and insults, being interrogated about his intentions, which forced him to make up excuses or, worse yet, tell outright lies. He didn't enjoy the dishonesty, but what choice did he have? Business was slow, and had been for the past year and a half. The rent on his small office was 3 months in arrears. He avoided the premises when possible, because his landlady was likely to pop up without warning, angling for payment. She insisted on cash, refusing to accept Pete's checks after the third one was returned for insufficient funds. He glanced at his watch, startled to see the time had gotten away from him. It was 9:43. He had an appointment at 10 o'clock, a job prospect that had come as a happy surprise. Fellow named Willard Bryce, young man by the sound of him, clearly unaccustomed to requiring the services of a private eye. During their phone conversation, Pete had pressed, trying to get a line on the problem, but the fellow was reluctant to specify. Pete was imagining a matrimonial issue, always depressing to contemplate. He removed his sport coat from the rack, hung his scarf around his neck, locked the office door behind him, and went out to the car, brooding about his lot in life. In his heyday, he'd hated having to stoop to domestic cases, which were emotional and messy, and seldom netted much in the way of returns. Confirm a woman's intuition that her husband was cheating, and suddenly she'd reverse herself, denying the truth even when the photographs were laid out in front of her. If Pete managed to convince her, she'd be too bitter or too upset to pay his fee. On the other hand, if he assured her of her hubby's innocence, the wife would claim he hadn't done his job. Why pay a PI who couldn't come up with the goods? Why was that worth $30 an hour, she'd ask, peevishly. Working the husband's side of the equation was no better. Pete would tease out the ex-wife's property holdings, providing proof she'd bought a condominium in Hawaii, while at the same time claiming her meager spousal support was inadequate to her needs. By the time a court date was set to review the facts, the husband would have piled up legal expenses so steep that he wouldn't have the bucks to pay the PI who'd provided the ammunition. He drove north on the 101, waving in response to the sour looks from passing drivers. His 1968 Ford Fairlane wouldn't exceed 55 miles an hour. The muffler was noisy, and the once fire engine red paint had faded to a harsh flamingo pink. It was a sweet drive for a 20-year-old vehicle with 278,000 miles on the odometer. On cold mornings, it took a fair amount of coaxing before the engine turned over, sending up dark puffs like smoke signals, visible in his rearview mirror. He'd bought the car at what he could see now was the height of his career. It ate up gasoline at a rate of 15 miles to the gallon, but it was otherwise low maintenance. He didn't want to dwell on the fact that the prospective client lived in Colgate, but it didn't bode well. Colgate was a lackluster sprawl of tract homes, built on land that had once supported citrus and avocado orchards. Colgate residents were workaday folk, plumbers and electricians, auto mechanics, store clerks and trash collectors. Not poor by any stretch, but getting by on wages that barely kept up with inflation. Actually, they all made more than he did, but that was neither here nor there. He'd been a damn fine detective once upon a time, and he was still good at what he did. If he cut corners on occasion, he figured it was strictly his business. He'd learned early on that in his line of work,